It is a favorite scenario in all kinds of fiction. The curtain is about to rise, the orchestra is in place, and yet the soloist has not arrived. Somebody has to step in and pinch hit. Well, last Friday night, stormy weather prevented H.K. Gruber from making it to Carnegie Hall, where he was scheduled to perform the vocal solo of his own composition with the St. Louis Symphony. Conductor David Robertson looked down a very thin bench and chose himself to pinch hit. The maestro relinquished his baton, and reviews said he sang the part with gusto. And it should be said that Gruber's whimsical piece called Frankenstein demands an uninhibited performance.
H.K. Brain he must have now. Two tall boots made for walking. Little feast made for heating. A casket for a basket. Two bright spurs upon his boot heels, which no
part. That was a recording of H.K. Gruber himself. In a moment, the pinch-hitting soloist David Robertson joins us. But we also want to hear from you. When have you had to step in at the last minute to pinch hit on stage at a public event, maybe on a ball field? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. There's a conversation at our website, too. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And David Robertson, music director of the St. Louis Symphony, is on the phone with us from Milan. So, Maestro, you've taken the show on the road?
No, actually, I left the musicians for a well-deserved vacation back in St. Louis, and I'm over here at the Theater of La Scala.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
When did you have to decide to put yourself into pinch hit?
Well, you know, I spoke to the people at Carnegie Hall when it was clear they were talking to the soloist and composer, and his flight was canceled, and so they flew him to Chicago, and then the flights were just dropping like flies, as they tend to when New York gets one of those sorts of days. And so they called up and they said, I don't think there's anybody that we could get as soloist. And I said, well, I think that the our associate sort of conductor, our resident conductor, a very gifted young man named Ward Stair, was on the earlier flight that did manage to get out with the musicians. So I thought, if he and the musicians arrive, we're in pretty good shape because, you know, I know the score, and luckily it asks for a chansonnier, which is not somebody who really sings, thank goodness, but can, you know, be like a sort of turbocharged raconteur to tell all of the stories.
Rex Harrison on steroids.
I think so, yeah, something like that.
You do have a background with a vocal background.
Well, when I was younger, I couldn't decide whether to go into theater or whether to go into music, and I did a great deal of singing. But then in terms of the actual music that I chose as a profession, I was all involved with instrumental music, and though I've done a lot of opera, so I've worked with a lot of singers, and I know a great deal about singing, I would never put an audience through listening to me sing in public, but there didn't seem to be any way to get around this one.
As you were looking ahead on the score, and I'm told that real musicians can look ahead on the score and not just keep up with what they're doing, are there moments where you're saying, oh my heavens, I don't know about this?
Well, there were a couple of places in the score where I thought, don't try this beforehand. Because if you try it beforehand and it doesn't work, it is going to so mess with your mind that you won't be able to do things. So just try it when you're out there. And the other thing which I really only realized once the performance started that I had to guard against is, you know, when I'm working with the St. Louis Symphony, it's a fabulous, fabulous orchestra. And so it's such a joy to conduct them, but it's kind of like you're in the driver's seat. Whereas when you're a soloist with them, and you're looking at the score, and I had total confidence in Ward Stair conducting next to me, I thought, gee, I can look at the score now. And, of course, I was looking at it in a kind of passive, I wait for my next entrance way. And they were playing so unbelievably well that I thought, look out, you're going to miss your entrance! You know, because I was just totally absorbed in how wonderfully they were doing everything. And that would have been rather tragic, just to, you know, particularly as I had the whole score there. And theoretically, as a conductor, I can read music.
And theoretically. It's also should be pointed out, this part requires you not just to sing some exuberant passages, but also to play the kazoo.
Yes, you play the kazoo and you also play the slide whistle, Swanee whistle, I think some people call it. And there are all sorts of things. He wants He wants voices of differing types. There are places in which you have dialogues between two different people, and so one of them has to be a very high, innocent-type-sounding voice, and the other one has to be kind of a low, mad scientist. And Gruber's voice itself is an amazing instrument. He goes from a really deep bass voice all the way up to extremely high falsetto notes. And so he's written all of that in the score, and having performed it with him, what was very difficult was to actually remember, now, don't try and do it like he does.
Like he does.
Because you just can't. You have to do it the way you do it.
You're not the male Ema Sumac.
No. I mean, it's not one of those things where you can... Plus, the other thing is he has this wonderful Austrian accent when he does it. And I couldn't do that, but I do a fairly passable imitation of John Wayne and of Vincent Price, and I tell you I really used those to the utmost.
It should be pointed out that in that same concert you also did some conducting as well of Sibelius V, which the New York Times raved about, so you're not ready quite to quit your day job yet.
No, and in fact that was the next night. Luckily, we had two nights, but on that evening it was an evening in which we played Mozart's musical Joke, and when the audience came in, we decided not to make an announcement, and they saw the members of the orchestra, some of whom were in evening concert attire and some of whom were just in traveling street clothes, and they all thought that it was part of the joke that we were doing with Mozart's musical Joke. So it did work very well, and then we saved the best for the second half and announced that not only were their clothes had their clothes not arrived, but in fact the soloist hadn't arrived, and so we figured that way no one would leave.
Here's an email that we got from Barbara in St. Louis. In anticipation of Mr. Robertson's appearance on the air, I want to let you know that his actions are not atypical. Over the holidays, our orchestra played accompaniment to the showing of The Wizard of Oz in Powell Hall. Every musician was wearing ruby slippers, including, yep, the maestro himself. We love him in St. Louis.
Yeah, it's a really, really special organization. And I have to say that I think if I hadn't had such amazing musicians surrounding me to play the accompaniment, there's no way I would have trusted myself to go out and do it. Because anytime you're a soloist, and this is why soloists love to play with us, whether they're, you know, whether it's Yo-Yo Ma or Emmanuel Axe or Carita Mattila, they all come and they know that you can really step outside of the box and do anything you want, because the musicians are so sensitive, so subtle, and so quick that they pick up on anything, and it's absolutely like making chamber music with 100 people on stage.
Well, again, congratulations, and enjoy your well-deserved vacation.
Thank you very much.
That is David Robertson, the music director of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, describing his role as the pinch hitter called up at the last minute, in this case by himself, player manager, if you will. So we want to hear your examples of when you've been called in at the last second to pinch hit. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Zap us an email at talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Dave. And Dave's on the line with Rochester from Rochester, New York.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm a Lutheran pastor, and I've had actually two pretty dramatic pinch-hitting opportunities. 7 years ago, after just a week after a wonderful 90th birthday party for my grandmother, she passed away suddenly, and the parish of which she was a member was without a pastor, and I was pressed into service to conduct her services, and that was well, it was quite touching, and it was something of a boon to me, because I think conducting the services gave me a way to a structure for my
grief.
Many of my siblings and cousins were all somewhat amazed that I was able to do it, but actually it was a help to me. And about 4 years ago, I'm a visiting minister generally, but I was expecting a Holy Week like this to be off. But one of my colleagues suddenly took ill, and I was literally thrown in as is today. I was called up on Wednesday to conduct the services Monday, Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter at a neighboring parish.
Wow, boy. Right into the firing line.
Yep.
Dave, thanks very much, and good luck.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Paul in Los Angeles. On a sunny summer Saturday in Michigan, I was reporting on an appearance by the lieutenant governor in Charlotte, just south of Lansing. About 150 people showed up. There was a high school band. I was the only reporter. I set up my microphone and then blended in as best I could at the back of the crowd. The MC, Jerry Rowe, was the executive director of the state GOP. He welcomed the crowd and then said the national anthem was to be sung today by local radio personality and introduced me. He turned, grinning impishly, and the crowd around me parted. Now I have a voice that would drive the sun behind the nearest cloud, not to mention frighten small children and drive any composer to consider ditch digging as a long career. Then I noticed the microphone had one of those on-off switches at the handle. Grabbing the mic, I switched it off, nodded to the band, and started out. True enough, everybody started to sing, and nobody noticed that I have a voice like sandpaper. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line, and let's go to Michael. Michael with us from Montrose in Colorado.
Hello there.
Hi there.
I'm a neurologist here in a small community hospital, and just recently I got called to admit a patient who had uncontrolled seizures, and she's up in the ICU, and she's kind of a big lady. I got a call from the emergency room. They said, well, you know, when she came in, we found out she's a little bit pregnant, just to let you know, with her seizures. So I was up in the ICU, and there's a tech doing an ultrasound to determine what's happening with that pregnancy. And before you know it, there's a head popping out. And as a brain doctor, I go back to med school days 15, 20 years ago, and I got the baby out. The obstetrician came and cut the cord, and so I go down as the delivering physician. As a neurologist. Everything came out okay.
Well, that's great. It just goes to prove the old saw that there's no such thing as being a little bit pregnant.
Exactly.
Michael, thanks very much. Congratulations.
Thank you. Bye.
We're talking with pinch hitters today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Tom's on the air from Windsor in Connecticut.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, I had a chance to literally pinch hit. About 2 years ago, my son, who plays on a baseball team, asked if I would want to come see him at Cooperstown at Abner Doubleday Field. I said, sure, and we showed up in the afternoon for the first game. And the manager turned to him and said, you know, two of our players got caught up on the Mass Pike. They were coming from Boston. He turned to me and he said, where do you want to play? And I said, you're kidding. I'm 64 years old. He said, I'm not. So I ended up playing a doubleheader at Abner Doubleday Field at 64 years of age and had a wonderful time.
Let me guess, right field.
First base, the only place you can play when you're my age. Otherwise, you have to run.
And how'd you do with the bat, Tom?
Got my bat on the ball 7 times out of 8 swings, 8 times at bat. Didn't get it out of the infield, though, I'm sorry to say.
Well, nevertheless, few of us can say that we've played a doubleheader at Abner Doubleday Field.
It was a wonderful experience.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go to Rudy. Rudy with us from St. Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I was a young reporter at the Washington Post in the late 80s, and I was a guest on what was then sort of the all-talk, what was the all-talk radio station, and NBC owned an operated station in D.C. called WRC, which was very popular. And after I came off the show as a guest, the station manager called me up. I didn't know who he was. He called me upstairs to his office, and he said, how'd you like to have your own show?
Huh.
I said, I'm a print guy. What do you mean radio show? He said, no, 4 hours, Saturday morning, 9 to 1. I said, well, that's ridiculous. I have no training in radio. I know nothing about how to run a talk show on radio. But what had happened was a guy named John McLaughlin, a guy named Fred Barnes, and a guy named Mort Kondracki all had weekend shows on WRC, 4 hours each. That's 12 hours of programming. And they were all leaving Swoop to start the John McLaughlin show on television. And I said, look, I can't do radio. I have no training. You know, you start in a small town, you work. He said, oh, shoot the clock. My first 2 days were Christmas and New Year's. There are no commercial breaks because no one buys commercials on Christmas. There were no listeners because no one listens to talk radio on Christmas. And I was panicked. I had to book my own guests, and all I could find was a woman in New York who was a stripping Santa, figuring, well, that'll get some irritated people to call. Zero. In the first hour, I had to talk. The second hour, I had the dog. After the second hour, one light lit up on the board, mercifully, and I punched it. The guy said, you know, I've been listening to you the last couple of hours. You know, I can't believe you made it this far. I said, hey, I want to talk to you. He hung up.
Oh, no.
And that was my baptism into talk radio, which never became a career, but it was the most awkward, uncomfortable Christmas and New Year's I've ever spent.
Well, it's a fate that we wish on all other radio hosts.
Well, I remember an old Saturday Night Live skit with Buck Henry where he was a talk show host and nobody was calling. And he began perspiring, and it just kept getting worse and worse, and he kept trying to up the ante on the topic, finally saying, you know, I really think the communists should come over and rape all our mothers and daughters. What do you think? Give me a ring on this number. And still no calls, and that's what I felt like that Christmas day.
Rudy, thanks very much, and we hope you're thriving in whatever other profession you're in now.
Well, I do a PBS show now.
But, okay, well, TV's okay. Just stay out of radio.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Now let's see if we can go to Amanda. Amanda with us from St. Louis.
Yeah, actually, I sing with the St. Louis Symphony Chorus.
Really?
Yes, I do. I really appreciate the previous caller. That's hilarious, turning off the microphone before singing the national anthem. I wish I'd thought of that. But I've been known to do that on dares before. That's been a lot of fun. But we here at the Symphony, we've done a lot of things in different languages, Hungarian, everything. Well, we did a piece earlier this year from The Lord of the Rings, which was in Elvish. And our wonderful chorus leader, Amy Kaiser, jokingly said, hey, does anybody speak Elvish? Well, lo and behold, yes, we had one person in the chorus who actually speaks Elvish.
Yeah. Klingon, too.
Yeah. I mean, you have to know how to pronounce this stuff before you can sing it. And honestly, who speaks Elvish? Well, someone in the chorus.
I hope the last line in the piece was, thank you very much.
Exactly. Had some hip gyrations.
Thanks very much, Amanda. How'd you do?
Thanks. I actually sat that one out. I went back to school a couple of years ago. So I had to miss out on that one.
All right, Amanda. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. We'll end with this email from Lewis in Arizona. As a ham radio operator, I was assigned to service the judge's stand at the last Phoenix Rodeo of Rodeos parade. When the DJ announcer was running late, I started going over the script just in case. When he did not show up, I was on. One of the most fun things I ever did, except for kiteboarding, of course. And, well, let's go out. This is, again, the H.K. Gruber performing part of that Frankenstein bit we were talking about earlier in the show. This is the part where he plays the kazoo. Tomorrow, it's Science Friday, and Ira Flato will be here to talk about teaching evolution in public schools in Texas, plus the new administration and climate change, and a fat that could keep you slim. That's all tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'll see you again on Monday. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.